Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Maura Ewing about a piece she wrote for Slate about Larry Krasner, Philadelphia's new district attorney, who is turning Philly's criminal justice system upside down, instituting dramatic new reforms. Then we'll be joined by Jeremy Adam Smith. He wrote a piece about why white men are stockpiling guns. He wrote that for Scientific American. And then we'll be joined by my Nation colleague, Katha Pollitt, to talk about her piece on Russia skepticism. And we have a really full show, so I'm going to skip the introduction. We're going to take a quick break and then just jump right into it. Stay tuned.
I smell a rat. Oh, I think I smell a rat. Oh, you little kids seem to think you know just where it's at. Oh, I think I smell a rat. Walking down the street, carrying a baseball bat. Smell a rat. Oh, you little kids, and you're thinking of just where it's at.
Back, folks. Elections matter. There was a local election in Philadelphia last year that got a lot of attention. It wasn't a race for a mayorship or city council. It was a DA race, a district attorney's race, and the winner was a guy named Larry Krasner. You might have heard about this. Krasner was a civil rights lawyer and a defense attorney who kind of switched sides and became the city's top prosecutor. But he didn't abandon his values. He ran on a full-throated platform of criminal justice reform. He's only been in office for a few months, but he's already making significant changes to how the DA's office does business. I'm pleased to be joined now by Maura Ewing. She was a writer in residence at the Fair Punishment Project, and she wrote a piece for Slate this week checking in on Krasner's first months in office. It's titled, Philadelphia's New Top Prosecutor is Rolling Out Wild, Unprecedented Criminal Justice Reforms. And you can check that one out at slate.com. Maura Ewing, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to share your piece. So it appears that Krasner's the real deal and that he's governing the way he campaigned. Can you go through some of the changes that he's made in how the DA's office responds to people who say, hey, my cousin or my brother or something was railroaded. He's an innocent person. He was wrongly convicted.
Sure. Yeah, that's been one of the very big internal changes that Krasner has made to the structure of his office. He really revamped the Conviction Integrity Review Unit by convincing one of the top lawyers in the field to move from Dallas to Philadelphia to run the unit, Patricia Cummings. So the unit essentially is it's not quite like an in-house innocence project. It's more like an in-house watchdog, I would say. They review past cases where there's a valid petition for innocence and suggest that they be reinvestigated, reopened. And they've already taken on, the unit was started under Krasner's predecessor, but they have increased their volume like more than tenfold in the first 2 months of her taking over the unit.
In January, we had on the show Mark Gotze. Mark is a former prosecutor. He's now with the Innocence Project, who's the co-founder of the Ohio Innocence Project. And he talked about how judges and prosecutors often tend to have these kind of cognitive biases that are perpetuated by the institutions in which they work. Prosecutors often assume that it's their job to punish people who do bad things to the full extent of the law. That is what they do. And it seems like Krasner's challenging that convention. This is a prosecutor who appears to be taking on mass incarceration directly. And of course, DAs have an enormous amount of prosecutorial discretion. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think that one of the first lines in Krasner's memo really sums it up when he says that he's bringing balance back to sentencing.
This is a memo to his staff.
Yes, this was a memo to his staff circulated earlier this week that outlined new policies that were made public officially yesterday. And I should note first that this is all for nonviolent crimes, non-sexual crimes, no felony gun charges. This is like relatively low-level stuff, but including some felonies. And essentially what he is saying is we are going to change the culture of sentencing where we are not going to seek the highest offer. We're going to start at the lowest end, and we're going to assume that if this case were to go to trial, the judge would find this this defendant to be sympathetic and offer, you know, at the lowest end of charges. And so this is both a policy shift and a culture, and asking for a culture shift within, particularly for, you know, career prosecutors. And so one of the provisions that he's made is that if prosecutors still have discretion, and if there is a case where they think that this isn't appropriate, you know, if someone has a troubling rap sheet or for whatever reason they think that the low sentence isn't appropriate, then Krasner or one of his first assistants has to sign off personally. So that's really signaling to his lawyers, you know, you have discretion, but I mean this. This is our new way of looking at things.
And this is a reverse of how they usually do things. So you write in the piece that 90% of cases are settled with a plea deal. It used to be that if you didn't want to seek the maximum, you had to get somebody at the top to sign off on that. And now it's, if you don't want to seek the minimum, you have to get someone to sign off on that. The assumption was always you go for the maximum every time. And he's also kind of, he's using his office's prosecutorial discretion to nullify certain laws, it seems. So marijuana, tell me about how he's treating marijuana and prostitution, theft of small petty theft, stuff like that.
So essentially he's saying fewer low-level cases will be brought and many will be dismissed is sort of a good way to summarize all of this. And with marijuana, he has essentially decriminalized possession of the drug. If a case is brought, if someone's arrested, his lawyers are to dismiss the case, not pursue charges. That doesn't include federal charges, I should say. So it might be a little bit complicated on the ground, you know, when police are arresting someone, what the outcome will be. And then for prostitution, this one's a little bit confusing. So he's saying, as of now, and there might be more reforms down the road, but if someone has less than two prior charges on prostitution, then the charges will be dismissed. And if they have two or more, then they'll be diverted to a sort of specialized court, which is similar to the drug courts that are common now, offering social services if someone abides by essentially probation. So I would guess that one's in a step moving towards decriminalizing prostitution, but he's not quite there yet.
One of the most incredible things in this, and I know this isn't your area, but there is a tangential area that it reminded me of, which is that conservatives have long been trying to get regulators to disclose the so-called cost of regulating something. So that they pine on this all the time. They say, oh, well, here's this regulation and it's going to cost, it's like an environmental regulation and it'll cost logging companies, for example, X amount of dollars to comply with this regulation. And it's an interesting way to kind of turn things on its head. And he's doing something similar with sentencing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. So this one is, I think, in a way more symbolic than it will actually have like a huge impact on defendants' lives. But I think it's an important symbol. He's requiring his lawyers when they're arguing for a certain sentence, and whenever they argue for a sentence, they have to include all of the factors that they think, rationalize that sentence: facts of the crime, a defendant's criminal history, and argue why it's a worthwhile sentence. And now they also have to include how much money it'll cost taxpayers to keep a person incarcerated for the recommended amount of time. So it's just really bringing home how much this system costs. And in his memo, he compared 1 year of a person being incarcerated to being comparable to a year's salary for a teacher or a social worker or a assistant district attorney.
It is symbolic, but I think it's kind of significant, and I can see it, shaping the way a judge looks at sentencing to some degree, at least on the periphery. And he set up the city's first safe injection site. He's trying. Okay. And here's something that really jumped out at me, especially after my interview with Mark Gotze. So Gotze talked about how much resistance he gets as a on the defense side from prosecutors. And he also said that he did the same with defense attorneys when he was a prosecutor. He said, he'd make their jobs as difficult as he possibly could within the confines of the law and judicial ethics, right? So he wasn't breaking the law or doing anything like that. But to the extent that he could, steamroll or delay or just make their jobs tough, he would. And he said that was part of the culture of being a prosecutor, and part of this kind of, it's obviously an adversarial system, and you think of it in an adversarial way. How am I going to trip up the defense? And Krasner is taking a very different approach in terms of his relationship with the public defender's office, right?
Yeah. And I should note, too, that she, Keir Bradford Gray, the lead public defender, Larry, had said if he would only run if she did not run last year. And she didn't, so he did. And I think that their relationship is really indicative of the way the system is being changed here. And obviously, in the courtroom, it's still adversarial. The lawyers are arguing against each other. But at the top level, they're on the same page with a lot of things.
And specifically, they're developing policy together.
Yeah, and so I think that's really interesting and something I'd like to write about more. And first, it's significant that both of these agencies have robust policy shops. That's sort of new. The Public Defender's Office got one, I think, 2 years ago, a staff dedicated to policy. And also two of Krasner's top policy people who were really well-regarded criminal defense and civil rights attorneys in the city before taking that office. They were also former public defenders and were like one-time colleagues with the public defender's policy expert. So I think that really sets the stage for how the discussions are going.
This is so interesting. So when you challenge established institutional norms, when you try to reshape their culture, when you try to change the way they do business, you're likely to face pushback. You talk in the piece about the police union, which, by the way, you would expect to just be belligerent because police unions are awful and they tend to be belligerent, just universally so. But you also have this whole career staff. You have people who have been in the prosecutor's office for, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 years. They've been doing business in a certain way. To what degree has Krasner's reforms faced a kind of pushback?
You know, I am not well-sourced enough in the rank and file to really have a sense of that. There hasn't been anything public, and I don't think there's been like any sort of mass exodus since he took office, aside from the people who were let go. I'm really interested to see if that does happen, and I don't think it would necessarily be a bad thing for his office if people who weren't on board decided to leave. I'm really not sure yet.
Well, it's early yet. I mean, he's been in office for 3 months, so this is a story that I hope you'll keep on top of, and maybe we could get you back to follow up in 6 months or a year or something like that. Folks, I said at the top that elections matter. I just want to point out that there are conservative outside groups that have been pouring money into judicial races and DA's races for... there was really an explosion, according to one report, between 2002 and 2010. And then Citizens United came along, and there is just a ton of money going to law and order prosecutors, law and order judges. And this hasn't been countered to a degree by advocates of criminal justice reform. This stuff is really important. And we need more Larry Krasners in more offices across the country if we're going to tackle criminal justice, the mass incarceration problem, racially discriminatory policing, et cetera, et cetera. It is a huge part of the equation. The piece, again, is titled Philadelphia's New Top Prosecutor is Rolling Out Wild, Unprecedented Criminal Justice Reforms. You can check that out at slate.com. Maura Ewing, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to shift gears and talk guns with Jeremy Adam Smith. Stay tuned.
Don't be scared. Stop acting weird. Soon we shall meet on our street. His music is sweet. Man, I caught your beat. You heard the news, old pal. Now don't run away. Show me respect, and don't you forget, like a fish in the sea, you're caught in my net.
Shaking up Orange Street. Whoa.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Jeremy Adam Smith. Jeremy edits Greater Good. It's a publication of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. He's also the author of The Daddy Shift. And this week he had a piece at Scientific American titled, Why Are White Men Stockpiling Guns? You can Google that headline or you can check it out at blogs.scientificamerican.com, all squeezed into one word. Jeremy, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. So it's funny, over the past couple of years, there have been a number of reports about how gun manufacturers are trying really hard to market their wares to women. There are gun fashion shows where designers unveil like evening gowns and casual wear with hidden holsters, and they're selling purses and whatnot with discreet spots to hold a firearm. They're making pink guns, which I personally can't see any self-respecting gun-toting lady to purchase, but maybe that's just me. And I guess your piece highlights why they're working so hard to win over the ladies. White dudes are disproportionately likely to own firearms. To what degree is gun ownership skewed toward this demographic?
Well, there's a fascinating report from the Harvard Entry Research Center that describes this. They look very, very deeply into gun owner demographics. And, you know, and their results are confirmed by the results of many, many other studies, which is that white men especially are way disproportionate gun owners. I mean, the industry's efforts to market to women have succeeded. Gun ownership has gone way up amongst women. However, the pattern is very different. What a female gun owner will buy a handgun for protection. And their survey shows that women disproportionately say that's why they own a handgun. However, unlike men, women will generally stop with that one gun. The pattern for not all men, not all male gun owners, but for many of them, is to keep buying guns and not just to, and to buy handguns and to buy hunting rifles, to buy assault rifles, to buy all kinds of guns. And there is a pattern that has emerged in this country during the past 10 years of what they call super owners, people who are stockpiling weapons to a point where 3% of the country owns half the firearms in the United States.
3% of the country owns half of the firearms in the United States. Let that sink in. And let me also just point to a 2015 study published in the Journal of Behavioral Sciences and the Law that I've written about at The Nation. They found that around 9% of the population, adult population in the United States, have a history of impulse and anger control problems and easy access to a gun. And here's the really interesting part of that. Around 1.5% of adults in the United States are angry, impulsive, and carry a gun with them. But they found that there was a significant three-way association among owning multiple guns, carrying a gun, and having impulsive, angry behavior. I mean, this is scary stuff. You write in the piece that there is a correlation, that this is consistent with other studies. Tell me just a little bit about that, as placing it into the larger body of research here.
Well, you know, before I answer that question directly, and I hope you'll come back to it, I want to say something about numbers like 9% or 1.5%. Because one of the pushbacks that I'm getting about this article is from people who are like, well, you know, I own, you know, 10 guns and I'm a collector and I'm perfectly, you know, I'm not prejudiced. I don't, quote unquote, have a racist bone in my body, or, you know, I don't have any anger control issues, or I've never been arrested. Stuff like that. And that's great.
That is great.
That's wonderful for them. However,
I mean, isn't it good that 98% of gun owners don't have angry impulsive? That is not 100%.
Yes,
I celebrate that.
Yeah, let's celebrate that. Let's take a moment to appreciate the fact that most of these gun owners just keep their guns locked away and they never hurt anybody, and that, except for maybe the occasional animal or target or skeet. And that's wonderful. But that small percentage of people, that minority of people, can be very dangerous to themselves and also to other people. And we as a society, you know, we just have to make a decision. You know, if it's worth the risk. You know, we know that people get killed. You know, and we have seen very rapid increases in gun deaths since the election of President Obama. And, you know, gun sales went up 22% under Obama. You know, a lot of right wingers were very afraid that Obama would take their guns away. That fear turned out to be totally unjustified. Gun sales went through the roof. Gun restrictions, if anything, loosened in many states, partially in response to gun massacres, because our culturally conditioned American response is to run out and get more guns for protection when we hear about gun violence. And we are seeing results now. You know, it's we have 10 years of results, and we can see that greater density of guns means more gun deaths, more people shot and wounded. This pattern is overwhelmingly clear. And, you know, and you can look at these numbers and you can look at, you know, and you can celebrate the fact that 99% of gun owners don't have anger issues. And yet we can still see this larger pattern of death and trauma.
Yeah. You know, well, let me point this out, though.
That is something we have to deal with.
And because we're throwing around data, because we're data type people. The gun owners, they tend to be like, there's this crackpot named John Lott. He's a widely debunked fraudulent researcher, and they always believe whatever he puts out. But there, you know, even while there are a lot of, I mean, like, let's put it this way, most gun owners are reasonable people and try to be safe. But there was a study that was released that was published in the American Journal of Public Health, and it found that over half of U.S. gun owners self-report that they don't store their gun safely with a trigger lock or locked up. So even responsible and you're not racist, if you're leaving your guns hanging around so that somebody can steal it out of your car, or that's a problem unto itself. So there is a lot of facets to this problem.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, gun thefts are going up. You know, and that does lead to more gun crime. I mean, intrinsically, these are criminals stealing. The minute you steal a gun, you become a criminal. It becomes very likely that criminal will use the gun.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
I mean, the bottom line is we just have a tremendous number of guns sloshing around in our society. And it's great that a majority of gun owners store their guns safely, use them responsibly, and don't have anger control issues. But, you know, you will always have a percentage of people who are not careful and who aren't always going to be emotionally stable, because people change over the course of their lives. You know, a lot of us are just one layoff or one divorce away from losing it. And that's the human reality.
Yeah, I'm closer to losing it than that. So it's interesting that you know, we're talking about this I think that the gun lobby really does. It has a number of consistent messages that muddle the debate and make it very hard to do something about the problem. But they really treat guns like they're just no problem. Like that they're safe. That, I mean, even when you have these like derpy things like, oh well, why don't you ban all cars? Like, we heavily regulate cars because we recognize that they're dangerous, you know?
Yeah.
So let's go back to the question. Place this into the larger body of research. You cite some other studies as well.
Well, I mean, I've sort of touched on that. You know, cars. Okay, let's talk about cars for a moment. Cars, to a certain degree, are a problem. you know, people do die from accidents. Cars also are a factor in global warming and climate change.
Yep.
And we have responded pretty systematically with regulations that are designed to mitigate those negative impacts. You know, we had seatbelts installed, we had airbags installed. You know, there have been numerous technological structural changes to cars over the years, and we know that has saved lives. And you know, and we're in the midst of a transition right now to using cars that have a much more reduced environmental impact. And I hope that's going to ultimately make a difference. Okay, so guns. You know, guns are a weapon, you know, a gun. People use them for fun. You know, they shoot at targets, you know, and they also use them for hunting. And for people who live in rural areas, you know, they use them as tools in various ways. In some cases, you actually need a gun for protection from animals. That's great. I don't think anybody really has a quarrel with that. However, we have a situation in this country right now where we have steadily deregulated guns. You know, we don't have a well-regulated militia anymore. What we have are people being able to walk into a gun show, people in many states being able to just walk into any sporting goods store and walk out with an assault rifle. And, you know, and we have, and that has created a demand that gun manufacturers have gladly met. You know, the as I say at the start of my article, we have seen a huge jump in gun manufacturing, gun imports, and gun sales since the election of President Obama.
Although now there's a Trump slump. Gun sales are down now that you don't have a black Democrat in the White House. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I many gun owners will say, and I get, this is another pushback I get on my article, it's like, I'm not a racist. Well, I understand that. You know, we understand that we all have our self-image, and, you know, and we sort of cling to that as tightly as we cling to things like guns.
Right.
And that's great.
Have you ever, have you ever encountered anybody who admits to being a racist?
Maybe
white supremacists and neo-Nazis and stuff like that, but I mean,
well, more and more of them now, right? I mean, more and more,
true.
I think a lot of white supremacists are coming out of the closet.
Yeah,
but,
you're right about that.
You know, it's something that happens in rings. You know, like one thing I hear a lot is, you know, I'm not a racist, but, you know, Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization. And you'll say, well, you know, I'm a white person, as you can probably hear in my voice. And I will say to my fellow white people, well, actually not. You know, it's a movement that is saying to, you know, our country that, you know, it matters that black people, especially black men, are disproportionately killed by police. And there are decisions we can make that will reduce that number of deaths. And Black Lives Matter is using, you know, the traditional methods of protest and advocacy to make a difference on that front. You can point that out. You can point that out from here to next Tuesday. But there's a kind of subconscious, implicit bias at work that sees any kind of advocacy from black people as being threatening.
Yes.
And there's a certain kind of white person who just reaches for their gun when they feel that threat.
Well, let's establish this for the listeners, by the way, because we've skipped ahead, right? Your title is "Why Are White Guys Stockpiling Guns?" Why? What does the study find as far as their motivation?
Right.
We skipped that basic premise. We've been
the biggest conscious reason why people buy guns in the United States is for self-protection.
Yes.
You know, the number of people who buy guns, according to most studies, to protect themselves from other people outnumbers the people who buy guns to protect themselves from animals by about 3-1. And that makes perfect sense. We don't really live in environments with a lot of threatening animals.
Yes.
Most of us. So, you know, there's a lot of, like, that's why people buy guns in the United States. That's what drives it. They feel very threatened by other people.
Self-defense is the number one reason cited in study after study. And it's about 2/3 of gun owners say that they have it for self-defense.
Yeah, that's right. So teams of researchers over the past 10 years have gone out and talked to representative samples of different kinds of gun owners. And they ask the questions in different ways. And sometimes they ask the participants in the study to take what's called an implicit aptitude test. And they are looking for specific signs of implicit racial bias, oftentimes. There are other kinds of scientific instruments, like the symbolic racism scale, that tries to sort of understand both what people consciously believe about people of other races, as well as what they subconsciously believe. And there's a difference, you know, I mean, there's a difference between implicit bias, subconscious bias, this kind of stuff that is culturally conditioned, and explicit bias, embracing explicitly racist beliefs. So though even there, many people will say, well, it's not racism to hate and fear Muslims. First of all, it's a religion, you know, and second of all, it's totally rational. And I'm not going to argue that point here. I'll sort of leave it up to the listeners to decide.
We'll have to do another segment on that one. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, researchers have various ways of discovering if somebody harbors conscious racist beliefs or just has a very high level of subconscious bias. And these studies find again and again and again, not just in one study, not just in two studies, not just in three studies, but in multiple studies over time, a very strong association between both implicit and explicit bias and gun ownership. And that's a problem. That is a powder keg. And that's what we have to deal with. And that's why it's worth asking, why are white men stockpiling guns?
It's really interesting. Yeah. And, you know, you have this 2/3 of gun owners saying that they have it for protection. But the reverse is actually true. I wrote about a huge meta-analysis that was published a couple of years ago. I think it was in 2014, the Annals of Internal Medicine. They looked at all of these previous studies and they put all the data together and they found that having easy access to a firearm makes you almost twice as likely to become the victim of a homicide as someone who does not have easy access to a firearm. You're three times as likely to kill yourself if you have easy access to a firearm. And for women, they are three times as likely to become a victim of homicide if there is easy access to a firearm in the house. So you buy a firearm. The reason I don't have guns is because it's not safe. I don't want to get killed. Yeah. And, you know, a friend of mine is a veteran, and he has guns. He keeps them locked up. He hunts, so he has hunting rifles. He keeps them locked up. He's a very responsible gun owner. And he says, and he's also a gun control advocate, and he says the thing that people don't understand is that as soon as you grab a gun and you carry it outside, your chances of getting into a gunfight increase exponentially. You have a gun on you, and it's really it's the data is so compelling. I almost think that it's like denying global warming, right? So you have in the global warming debate,
like
right? Uh-huh. I mean, you have some crackpots who, you know, say it's solar rays or something like that, and you have people who promote those ideas. So that if you are motivated to disregard evidence, you know, solid evidence, you can latch onto one of these crackpot studies about solar radiation or whatever. Just like you have John Lott, this fraudulent gun researcher who makes up these statistics. And no matter how much solid data is published in peer-reviewed publications, they just blow it all off and insist that that guns make them safer when all evidence is to the contrary.
Yeah.
It's very, very frustrating. I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me. I really do appreciate it. And I could gab with you for hours, I can tell.
All right. Well, it was great to be on, and thank you very, very much.
Folks, the piece is called Why Are White Men Stockpiling Guns? You can check it out at blogs.scientificamerican.com. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. Stay tuned.
What's the matter with your life? Why you gotta mess with mine? Don't keep sweating what I do, cause I'm gonna be just fine. Check it out. If I wanna take a guy home with me tonight, cheap 2 cents in. Don't you got nothing to do? Then worry about my friends. Check it, I can't do nothing.
to me, but now I see it wasn't. They told me to change it, call me names, and so I popped one. Opinions are like, then everybody's got one. I never poke my nose where I'm not supposed to. Believe me, if it's something that I want, I'm stepping closer. I'm not one for playing high pole like the Hossa did in 90210 type of hoe. I treat a man like he treats me. The difference between a hooker and a hoe ain't nothing but a feat. So hold your tongue tightly. Wish you could be like me. You're popping all that mess, only the stress and the spite me. Now you could get with that or you could get with this, but I don't give a fuck, cause really it's none of your business.
1993, S&P, packing and macking, bamboozling and smacking suckers with this track in. Throw the beat back in.
If I wanna take a guy home with me tonight,
it's none of your business.
And if she wanna be a freaking, sell it on a weekend,
it's none of your business.
Now you shouldn't even get into who I'm giving skins to,
it's none of your business.
So don't try to change my mind, I tell you one more time,
it's none of your business.
How many rules am I to break before you understand that your double standards don't mean to me? I know exactly what you say when I turn and walk away, but that's okay, cause I don't let it get to me. Now every move I make, somebody's clocking, so ask me nothing, will you just leave me alone? Never mind who's the guy that I took home to bone.
Okay, Miss Thing, never giving up skins. If you don't like him or his friends, what about that Benz? Your pet pep's got an ill rep with all that macaroni trap. For rap, you better step, or better yet, get your head checked. Cause I refuse to be played like I've been his trick deck of cards. No, I ain't hard like the bitches on a boulevard. My face ain't scarred and I don't dance in bars. You can call me a tramp if you want to, but I remember the punk who just humped and dumped you. Or you can front if you have to, but everybody gets horny just like you. So, yo, so, yo, ho, check it, double deck it, on the regular butt naked. Pep's ass gets respected, miss, but it's none of your business.
If I wanna take a guy home with me tonight,
it's none of your business.
And if she wanna be a freaking, sell it on a weekend,
it's none of your business.
Now you shouldn't even get into who I'm giving skins to,
it's none of your business.
So don't try to change my mind, I tell you one more time,
it's none of your business.
So, the moral of this story is, who are you to judge? There's only one true judge, and that's God. So chill and let my father do his job.
The soul and pepper's got it swinging again. The soul and pepper's got it swinging again. The soul and pepper's got it.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm really happy to welcome Katha Pollitt back to the show. Katha is, of course, a writer for The Nation, and she wrote a piece this week titled Let's Get Real About Russiagate. Katha Pollitt, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me, Josh.
Thanks for taking the time. So let me just start by getting your reaction to some news. We're taping this on Saturday morning, the Andrew McCabe firing. McCabe was fired a day before he would have been eligible for a pension, and a day before he was set to retire anyway. It just seems so cruel and vindictive, but it also seems self-destructive if you're a president who wants to keep Russiagate out of the news.
Well, this is what I think. I don't understand this at all. I think it's as if Trump is becoming like Henry VIII. He just sort of lashing out at people. I mean, he can't behead them anymore. That's good. But it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the thing that McCabe was alleged to have revealed that he shouldn't have was something that worked against Hillary. So Trump should like that.
I mean, it's bizarre that he's been attacking McCabe for being a Democratic partisan because his wife ran for Congress. And it's a really tangential kind of connection. Someone close to Hillary gave his wife money or something like that. It's a Terry McAuliffe. But this is the thing, you know, you, in your piece, you knocked down a bunch of claims that so-called Russia skeptics, and I don't think they're skeptics, because I think that it's ideologically motivated or motivated by tribalism, by the desire, in most cases, by the desire to make sure that Hillary doesn't evade any responsibility for losing to Donald Trump. But the skeptics, you knocked down a bunch of claims by the skeptics. One that you didn't go into is that Democrats are obsessed with this and are driving the story. And the thing that strikes me about this is that the person who has done more to keep the Russiagate story alive than any human being on the planet is Donald Trump.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. Now, I called them skeptics because I wanted a one-word descriptor, but I actually agree with you about their motives, the motives of people who are just questioning, you know, throwing every rotten tomato at any idea that Russiagate actually happened and mattered. I think that there is an ideological motive behind it, and I think it's hatred of the Democratic Party. It's this bizarre sympathy or empathy or whatever for Putin, which I don't understand at all. You know, in an earlier piece on this same theme, because I feel, you know, given that it's the nation where we have five people going on and on and on about how Russiagate is a big nothing, I feel I have to every now and then write a piece that sort of presents the alternative point of view. But in an earlier piece, I pointed out that Russia is not the Soviet Union. It is a capitalistic kleptocracy.
And it's right-wing.
It's right-wing, it's racist, it supports a kind of, it's tied in with a very conservative kind of Orthodox Christianity. It doesn't stand for anything that anyone writing for the nation believes in or admires.
Extraordinarily hostile towards LGBT people, extraordinarily so.
And it's anti-Semitic, it's everything bad, and I do not understand this affection. I mean, when the word McCarthyite is deployed, as it invariably is, along with the word hysterical, when the word McCarthyite is deployed, it calls up feelings that are based on the political arrangements of, you know, 40 years ago. It is not McCarthyite to say that this is all happening. And it also calls up the idea that the people who are skeptics are suffering, that they lose their jobs, that they're pariahs in their community. None of that is true. Glenn Greenwald is on TV all the time.
It's like all of these premises are false. So, you know, the fact if whether or not Russia meddled in the election has no bearing on whether Hillary Clinton ran a good campaign or not, right? It shouldn't have been, you know, if you want to dump on Hillary, it's easy to square that circle. You just say it shouldn't have been close enough for them to have been able to have any kind of impact, or it shouldn't have been close enough for James Comey to have an impact. And with the Seth Rich thing, first of all, it's not a leak, because leaks, when we talk about leaks, we're implying, you know, a revelation of some wrongdoing, because he's been called a whistleblower too, right? The idea is that someone blew the whistle. But the Steele dossier said that Russia had somebody inside the DNC.
Well, there you go.
So even if that theory wasn't completely the central premise of that theory, which is that the data could not have been downloaded fast enough. And just so listeners know what we're talking about. So there's this theory that says, and it was published in The Nation as well as other places, that there's no way that they could have hacked those emails, because it would have taken because internet speeds are not fast enough to do it within the time frame that it was supposedly done. And they used standard kind of like home internet speeds to do this. But there are faster ones that any self-respecting hacker would use. There's faster methods to upload data. And just the whole premise is ridiculous. I should also say that, you know, there are a few people among the so-called skeptics who are acting on, I think, deeply held beliefs about the geopolitical relationship between Russia. Like, Stephen Cohen has been a Russia expert for his whole career. But when you look at, but most of them seem to me to be motivated by this desire to not let Hillary off the hook. And I will point out, as I have many times in the past, that I cannot name a single Russia skeptic who is not hostile towards her nomination. The reverse is not true. Plenty of Bernie Sanders supporters, including myself, take Russiagate seriously.
Yes, I think that Hillary is at the bottom of it, as she is of so many things, that they just want her to be punished. They want the Democrats to wallow in their failure. They want them to say, well, if only we had nominated Bernie Sanders, none of this would have happened, as if, you know, of course it would have happened. Donald Trump in Russia wouldn't have been any more for Bernie Sanders than they were for Hillary.
Well, actually, the intelligence agencies, I'm not sure that that's true.
Yeah.
In that the intelligence agencies say that Vladimir Putin has had an intense hatred for Hillary Clinton and also blamed her for being behind protests against his 2012 election.
Okay. Maybe you're right, and maybe
we don't know. But
yeah, it's an unknown unknown. But I guess what really bothers me is that there's such a reluctance to grapple with the actual facts. For example, Jane Meyer's piece about the Steele dossier was pretty impressive, and they don't talk about that. They just talk about, it's all to me on the level of things like, well, if Russia meddled in our elections, it's nothing we haven't done in other countries. So, you know, tit for tat, two wrongs make a right. I mean, it's not as if the Russians interfered to avenge our overthrow of many democratically elected governments in the third world.
And the implication,
or what we used to
call
the third world.
But the implication is also, if you think about it, that Iranians shouldn't complain about us being involved in the overthrow of Mossadegh. I mean,
right.
if you're supposed to just take it, right? I mean, if this is the normal course and every country interferes
with everybody
else. No, only America's
supposed to take it. America's supposed to take it. The other countries are allowed to protest. But the point is that that if the Russians did meddle in our elections, they did it to achieve their own ends. They weren't saying, oh, yes, we are the great left-wing, pro-developing world power in the world, and we're going to get those evil imperialists. It had nothing to do with that. They're imperialists too. So I guess there is a piece of this that has to do with actually sort of liking Russia.
It's very
and
weird.
That I really don't understand it, because we here on the left should be opposing everything Putin stands for.
Yeah.
And most of us do.
I really feel strongly that I mean, and I have priors about this because I am Russian and I was raised to be very wary of those people. So I will concede that I have a certain bias. But I mean, look, let's concede, as we should, that we have no proof, no solid proof. There's just a lot of evidence. And one of the kind of rhetorical tricks here is that they say, well, there's no evidence, when they really mean there's no proof. There's tons of evidence that something was happening, all these clandestine meetings. People don't risk jail to cover something up if it's completely on the up and up. Something was going on. Clearly between the Trump campaign and the Russians. We don't know what it is at this point. And the other thing that I would point out is that I personally don't believe that the Russians are responsible for Trump's election. I believe that they contributed to a larger effort to demonize Hillary Clinton in a way that made it acceptable to vote for Trump. So this was an effort that was undertaken by the Trump campaign. It was undertaken by the Russians. It was undertaken by all these, you know, conservative outside groups. It was helped along by the mainstream media and their focus on Clinton scandals. But I don't believe that the Russians alone are responsible for Donald Trump. And if you ask Nate Silver, for example, at 538, he says, look, there's very, very compelling evidence that Comey's statement 11 days before the election is what shifted the polling. And he has identified very significant change in the race that happened just at that moment. So with all those things being said, though, it is frustrating to me that we spend, you know, countless hours focused on whatever phony scandal the, you know, like Republicans will make a scandal out of nothing. Here we have a real issue. It's not coming from, you know, MSNBC. It's coming from the intelligence community. It is very damaging to a horrible president. And, you know, at a minimum, I feel like even if you're not all on board, you should appreciate the damage that it's done to his presidency and at least wait till we get a definitive conclusion to the investigation, to Mueller's investigation. Anyway, Katha, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me, Josh. It was fun.
It's always fun. I'd also like to thank Maura Ewing and Jeremy Adam Smith. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find podcasts. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I will check that email account someday. Maybe. And I'd like to thank the folks at Crooks and Liars, Hullabaloo, and The Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their joints. Of course, I want to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.